Our speaker, by name and writings, represents the Reformed tradition. Dr. Richard R. Niebuhr has been professor of theology at Harvard Divinity School. This spring, that university recognized his distinguished service upon his retirement, but as he now describes his schedule, it would appear to be more like a reduction in load. I first met Professor Niebuhr in 1962 when I entered the graduate program in theology at Harvard. Through his lectures and writings, he introduced us and many others to the work of Friedrich Schleiermacher. Standing against the misreading and the ridicule of Schleiermacher in the 20th century, Professor Niebuhr opened these texts to readers as if they had just been discovered for the first time. Those who treasure the Mercersburg tradition will want to speak with Professor Barrett, who has pointed out connections between Schleiermacher and the faculty of this school when it was at Mercersburg. Since the publication of his book, Schleiermacher on Christ and Religion, in 1964, Professor Niebuhr has continued to analyze the ways we give expression to our faith in God. His preoccupation with language and symbols reflects a certain theological perspective, which you soon will encounter, but also his personal interest in language itself, which you also will have opportunity to ponder and enjoy in a moment. If there is a text for his work, I think it might be the first two lines of John Calvin's Institutes. And to quote Calvin, "Nearly all the wisdom we possess consists of two parts, the knowledge of God and of ourselves. But while joined by many bonds, which one precedes and brings forth the other is not easy to discern." Close quote. If true to himself, I am sure that Professor Niebuhr will invite you to reflect on the many bonds between God, ourselves, and our language. Richard Reinhold Niebuhr bears names that connect him to persons known and loved in this place. He is the son of H. Richard Niebuhr and the nephew of Reinhold and Hulda Niebuhr, all known for their writings and influence on religion in America in this century. He lives in Boston with his wife, Nancy, and they have a son and a daughter and three grandchildren. His son, Gustav, who bears the name of Professor Niebuhr's grandfather, writes for the New York Times on what you might expect, namely religion. Last evening, we spoke of many things, including Professor Niebuhr's desire to see how the Boston Red Sox were doing. When asked whether he intended to speak of baseball today, he noted that he might, since baseball uses signs and symbols. Professor Niebuhr, we are honored to have you with us and look forward to hearing your presentation on faith in search of living symbols. Would you join me in welcoming him?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Peter. Your quoting of the opening words of the Institute gives me courage. Well, it is a particular honor for me to be your lecturer, your Gerhardt lecturer this year. What I'm presenting to you I want to say at the very outset, is a work in progress. And I'm sure that what I have written here leaves much to be desired, and I hope to learn from you in whatever discussions may ensue. I've been very much occupied with the role of symbols, both in religion and in our daily lives, for many, many years. I'm not sure when all of that began, but in part I can attribute it to my reading and rereading of Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Biographia Literaria and his great theological work, Aids to Reflection, which had such a profound influence upon American theologians, philosophers, and preachers. Coleridge is to be found everywhere in Emerson and in Emerson's successors. To give you a guide to my lecture, let me indicate what I take to be the principal parts of the lecture. First of all, I shall be saying something about the Jesus' disciples and their questions of him, not only his disciples, but also others, including the Pharisees and scribes, their questions of him to the effect, teacher, give us a sign. And I will dwell on that particular, the significance of that that question. The second major division will be a rather brief reflection on the use of the words sign in its Latin and Greek as well as English forms in antiquity, and also upon the word symbol, or upon its Latin and Greek forms. From that, I shall move on to speak about the enormous, what I call the explosion of new interest in the nature of symbol that we find particularly among the artists, the poets, the philosophers that we subsume under the name Romantic. Of which Emerson is one. And then in the fourth section, I'm going to refer, more than refer, say a little bit about John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. A book that enchanted me when I first read it and has been in my life ever since. And finally, I will conclude with some comments on the relationship between habit and character and symbol. I will be changing my glasses from time to time, and I hope you'll pardon that. In chapter 21 of Luke's Gospel, verse 21, the evangelist writes that Jesus' disciples asked of him, "Teacher, when will this be? And what will be the sign when this is about to take place?" The occasion of the disciples putting this question is Jesus' apparent prediction of the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. Now, the word sign, or simeon, occurs in many, many passages, particularly in the Gospels. But not only in the Gospels, in the letters, and even, of course, in the book of Revelation. I want to place my emphasis on the use of the word sign, simeon, in this particular questions that the disciples addressed to Jesus. Give us a sign as to when this will take place. This particular episode in Luke and in parallel passages in the other synoptic gospels offers, or has offered to me, as I reflected upon these passages, the opportunity to characterize Christian faith or Christian life. I use those words almost interchangeably. Reflection offers me the opportunity to characterize Christian life and faith as a quest for signs. So happens that some of my colleagues and their graduate students are very much interested in the issue of the essence of Christianity. I have little interest in the essence of Christianity, but I don't propose to define it, but here I am characterizing the Christian life, the Christian faith, as such faith as endeavors to follow in the path or the way of Jesus. Such faith as seeks to interpret Jesus' mind, Jesus' teaching, and Jesus' conduct, and then strives to represent Jesus' mind and conduct in the minds and way of life of the interpreters themselves. My intention here is to offer a conception of Christian life and faith that is not so much doctrinal as it is ethical. or more precisely, offer a conception of Christian faith as seeking an ethos. I use the word ethos in its very old sense, standing for character. So that the interpretations, or the interpreters, excuse me, of Jesus aspire, when I say that they aspire to interpret Jesus' mind and Jesus' conduct and to represent his mind and conduct in their own lives. Interpreters of Jesus aspire then to acquire the character that was in Jesus. This word, this Greek word that I'm translating, and others certainly have translated as character, the word ethos, is the word from which our term ethics is derived. But as you may see or suspect, ethos has a much broader connotation than particular rules, or modes of reasoning, or rules of behavior. Heraclitus of Ephesus, according to the tradition, said a person's ethos or character is a person's destiny. I think that is a profound statement. In somewhat the same vein, though at many centuries removed, Coleridge, in his work, Age to Reflection, writes that Christianity is not a theory, but a life. So Christian faith, as I am endeavoring to understand it, or still endeavoring to understand it, is the endeavor to represent Jesus, not to copy Jesus, but to represent Jesus' mind and conduct. And the substantive word Christianity I use as a term to denote those persons who individually and more likely collectively aspire with all their hearts and minds and strength to interpret the teacher who interprets God. I mentioned the way I'm using these words, Christian and Christianity, so that you will not, I hope you will not, take me as engaging in some kind of reductionism when I say that Christian life is a quest of signs. More specifically, it is a quest to understand signs, and so it is a quest to interpret signs. And since every interpretation of a sign or any complex of signs, issues in further interpretation. Then one may say, I believe, that Christian life is a process of semiosis, that is, sign production. But remember that the process of sign production, as I am now using that phrase, the process of sign production in its most profound meaning is a quest of character. So Christians are, among other things, interpreters of signs, the charter documents of the Christian life, such as the Gospel according to Luke and the other Gospels, as well as the letters of Paul and others. I believe they all suggest as much. And indeed, Paul himself was also concerned with signs, but I do not plan to dwell further on New Testament passages that employ the word sign. Incidentally, I suppose I should make the observation that often the Greek for our word sign is translated as wonder. They seek signs and wonders. And in the book of Revelation, this word sign is translated as wonders in heaven. What I have said so far is that Christian faith or life is the quest of signs. In the case of the disciples that Luke describes in 21:7, they were asking about the future event that would presage the destruction of the temple and the advent of the end time. They were importuning their teacher to disclose the sign, the meaning of which would be the advent of the end. As one commentator puts the matter, the disciples want an infallible means of recognizing the approach of the end. They want to be relieved from having to watch. They want to be relieved of the burden of interpreting. I think we may say that they desired to know Jesus' mind. They wanted Jesus to disclose his thought in words, unmistakable words, which they might then interpret as signs pregnant with perceptible and palpable future meaning. And the disciples are not alone in that. Generation after generation has endeavored to interpret Jesus' mind, to find an interpretation that is infallible. But beyond, or I should say, in addition to the yearning to grasp the meaning of Jesus' words, here I am reiterating a point that I wish to emphasize heavily, Christians, at least by profession, have aspired to interpret Jesus' action and conduct in order that they might represent all these in their own behavior. Again, I emphasize, it's not so much copying as representing. And this aspiration to represent bespeaks the fact that not only words are signs, but actions also. Together they make up character. Hence, I believe it is appropriate to propose that the disciples and the subsequent generations of aspirants after a Christ-like life, not a Christ-copied life, regarded Jesus in his totality, in the totality of his sayings and deeds, regarded Jesus to be himself, as being himself, a sign, a profoundly complex sign, the interpretation of which can never be completed or exhausted. Now here perhaps I should say, make a few brief comments. Are an elaboration on this last remark. Namely, to Jesus' followers, Jesus himself was a complex sign. And to carry out this elaboration, I turn to make a few comments on the nature of sign or signs. These comments touch on the usage of the word in antiquity in both the Latin and Greek languages. And they touch also upon the other critical word, symbol, and the Latin and Greek words for sign and symbol. First of all, the term sign and symbol have long been used in other languages, as well as in our own, as being virtually interchangeable, as being roughly equivalent. We find, for example, Eusebius, the historian in the 4th century, reporting in his life of Constantine that the emperor experienced a vision of the cross, a vision of the cross as a divine sign, and heard the words, "In this implied sign, you shall conquer." Well, the word semeion, the Greek for sign, may function simply as signifying mark or token or indication. In this case, that is to say, the case that Eusebius is concerned with in the life of Constantine, the term evidently carries a very full, a very rich meaning, a virtual narrative meaning, what might call an iconic meaning, which conveys the life and sacrifice of Christ. Later on in the 5th century, we find that the bishops assembled at Chalcedon denominated the creed that they issued as a symbol. So the definition of Christ as being constituted of full divine or complete divine and complete human nature in one apostasis or subsistence, that creedal definition carried the rubric symbolon. But according to historians of creeds and early doctrine, the use of symbol as a virtual synonym for creed reaches evidently much farther back, certainly farther back than the Council of Chalcedon. Scholars apparently can do no more than conjecture how the term came into being, but that it came into being in the context of the Christian life, that is a significant point. They speculate that it came into being as the term designating the catechisms or baptismal professions of faith in the very early Christian community. A baptismal confession, in other words, serves as a publicly recognized badge identifying the confessor or professor as a member of the apostolic faith community. Now these two words, sign and symbol, as I've already suggested, may mean mark, token, indication, among many other things. But in its verb form, the word symbol, symboline in the Greek, means a casting or throwing together in such manner that the elements that have been cast or thrown together henceforth, or at least for the time being, make up a whole constituted of parts, with the one part implying, perhaps by virtue of customary association, one part implying the other. Then, in the case of creeds, confessions of the creeds, confession or recitation implies membership in the faith community. I do not mean to ignore the fact that these creeds, such as the Creed of Nicaea, the Nicene Creed of Constantinople, and the Chalcedonian Creed, the Athanasian, and many others, have also been employed as means of excluding many, many persons. Employed for political ends. So the Arians and the Monophysites and the Nestorians and so forth are thereby excluded from the Catholic Church. Well, I ask your pardon for going back so far. My purpose has been to prepare a way for understanding the explosion, or the significance, I should say, of the explosion of new interest in the conception of symbol in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. An explosion that, as I've already suggested, was ignited by a significant number of poets, literary figures, philosophers, and even theologians. By way of introduction to this reconceptualization, this, as it were, transformation of the idea of symbol, I quote a sentence from Ralph Waldo Emerson's essay. I can't resist making the aside that I have, out of deep sympathy with our many Unitarian students and also out of intrinsic interest in Emerson, I have been fighting a losing battle to get my theological colleagues to take Emerson seriously. By way of transition, I quote a line from Emerson's essay, The Poet, which appeared in the second series of his published essays, composed between 1841 and 1843. And in this essay, which is one of the most significant, I think, for understanding Emerson, Emerson says in his characteristic, cryptic, aphoristic way, we are symbols and inhabit symbols. And this suggests a very radical way of speaking. We are symbols and inhabit symbols. It was with this line of Emerson's in mind, as well as some other things that a great philosopher whose life overlapped that of Emerson, namely Charles Sanders Peirce, was with this line in mind that at the outset I spoke of Jesus as being a complex symbol. Emerson's words do not imply any kind of reductionism. On the contrary, they direct our attention to the fact that symbols are pregnant, they are freighted with life. Emerson's mentor, again, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, characterized symbols, and he was exhorting those who were preparing for the Christian ministry so to understand them, characterized symbols as living words, words that are alive. Which I take to be a phrase that is vaguely reminiscent of an early verse in the prologue of the fourth gospel. In the Word, that is Logos, was life. And the life was the light of human beings. The philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce, writing somewhat later, says the following. Peirce was a scientist and also a philosopher of language of signs. Peirce wrote, the woof and warp of all thought is the life inherent in symbols. Every symbol is a living thing in a very strict sense that is no mere figure of speech. Let me pause there to just call attention to the sharp contrast between the way Emerson is writing or talking and Peirce is writing and talking, and the way in which TV anchormen and TV anchorwomen use the word symbol. If something is symbolic, it's a facade, it's a deception, it's an illusion, it conceals more symbol than substance. Emerson believed there to be no real dichotomy between spirit and matter. And I can explain this or go on into further commentary on what Emerson thought. Suffice it to say that Emerson understands the human body as an issue of spirit. So there's no sharp body-mind dichotomy in Emerson's thinking. That means, among other things, that when he says, or I'm interpreting Emerson to be saying, affirming, that when, or if it is the case, as I believe it is the case, if we are symbols, then we are symbols through and through. Our gestures, not only our words, but our gestures, our posture, our facial expressions, are all symbolic communications. And one can go on, spatial arrangements of physical entities are symbolic arrangements. We interpret them, whether consciously or otherwise. So we are symbols and inhabit symbols. I want to explore this further, not by way of carrying out further exegesis of other Emersonian texts, but in my own fashion, but with the substantial assistance of any number of authors whom I have been reading for many years. To say that we are symbols means, at the very least, that symbolization is the essential act of mind. One might go even further, that sounds a little intellectualistic, that symbolization is the essential act of human being, and not just mind. Suzanne Langer, whose book Philosophy in a New Key has been so influential upon many. Near the outset of her book, writes, "The current of experience that passes through the mind is sucked into the stream of symbols which constitutes a human mind." The current of experience is sucked into symbols. Or to put it perhaps less aphoristically, to experience is to symbolize. So our words and thoughts are symbols. words being externalized thoughts and thoughts being inner words. Words which we address to others and also address to ourselves. But no less are bodily gestures symbols, such as pointing our finger at a constellation in the night sky, or frowning when we disagree with another person. Indeed, our habitual manner of comporting ourselves in the midst of society and nature makes up an infinitely complex system of symbols. We are systems, not in the sense of being closed systems. William James, one of the points on which I disagree with James, there's very little I disagree with James about. But James says at one point, to be a system at all, the system must be closed. And that seems to me profoundly unrealistic. Is to say that we are by nature interpreters. Interpreters, I've already used the illustrations I have in mind here, of the facial expressions of our companions and strangers, interpreters of their skin color. We are interpreters of acts of Congress, interpreters of cloud formations and meteorological maps, interpreters of biblical texts, interpreters of newspaper columns, and interpreters of the insistent gaze of our dogs when they look at us with piercing eyes. But to say that we are forever interpreting is to say that we are forever representing. To ourselves and to our partners in conversation, to our colleagues, to all with whom we live, we are interpreters of the meaning of these things or events. When I employ the verb represent and the substantive representation, I do not mean that we make a likeness of what we apprehend. What I do mean is that we represent what we apprehend. Every great painting, as you know, I'm thinking of Degas at the moment, is not simply a likeness of a ballet dancer, but it is a representation, a new manifestation of the ballet dancer. And so on. Representation in this sense means an engendering of a thought that stands for whatever, and by thought I mean any mental content. It can be a feeling, whatever. It means an engendering of a thought that stands for whatever is present to us, be it in the immediate moment or be it in memory, when we suddenly realize that an all but forgotten event or fact in our personal or family or collective life reveals a pattern in our contemporary experience. Experience that a moment ago seemed nothing but random confusion. Such a thought, as I've already mentioned, may be no more than a feeling of despondency or of inexplicable joy. Every representation is also an interpretation, and every interpretation begets a further interpretation. To make this point a bit more concrete, I turn to Bunyan's great work, The Pilgrim's Progress. We have to, I do so with trepidation, because I suspect, I shouldn't be too brash, it may be the case that some of you have not read The Pilgrim's Progress. When Bunyan's protagonist, I think The Pilgrim's Progress is the antecedent of the modern detective story, interpretation of signs, looking for clues. When Bunyan's protagonist, Christian, enters the house of interpreter, all of his thoughts and feelings, both of despair and of faint hope, become ordered into a new and a potent pattern of meaning, future meaning. He knows what to look for. Thenceforth, the pilgrim makes his way to Palace Beautiful and then into the Valley of Humiliation and the Valley of the Shadow of Death. The journey that this pilgrim, now named Christian, and his companion, Hopeful, the journey that they make to the celestial city is a journey of interpretation, of discerning signs and symbols, and trying to choose the right understanding of these signs and symbols. Incidentally, one can make the same point or expound upon Melville's great novel, Moby Dick, as likewise being a voyage of interpretation. But that voyage ends in destruction, because Ahab's interpretation is the dominant one. And so it's not quite as hopeful an example to use as Pilgrim's Progress. Bunyan's book, Pilgrim's Progress, is not fiction only. It is a re-symbolization, or you might call it a representation, of Bunyan's own life as he narrated it in his great autobiography, Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners. The two books really have to be read together. The story of the pilgrim Christian and his fellow sojourners become instantiations, or that the story becomes an instantiation of Emerson's dictum, we are symbols. For all of the wayfarer's actions, thoughts, fears, and conversations with each other constitute complex personalities, complex persons who are themselves symbols. That they function as symbols is testified by the fact that, for example, as families made their way in the 1840s to Oregon, rumbling in their wagons over hard trails, mothers read the Pilgrim's Progress to themselves and to their children as interpretations of who they are or were. I sincerely hope that what I've tried to say in the last few minutes makes clear that Emerson's clause, "We are symbols," requires the second parallel clause, "and inhabit symbols." We are symbols and inhabit symbols. As living, symbolizing beings, we live in worlds of symbols. We inhabit symbols. And the symbols we inhabit become our habits. We are symbols and inhabit symbols. Coleridge, for example, called the Bible a system of symbols. I think he was the first to use that phrase, system of symbols. And points out to us the fact that we are reading a system of symbols, namely Scripture, in the midst of many other complexes of meaning, or systems of symbols. Coleridge was fighting the historical critical reduction of the Bible, to mere products of the mythic mind. And so insisted upon living symbols. So to read is not only to read, so to say, Scripture, let us say anything you choose, but it is also to dwell in. And since we read so much, we dwell in so many symbolical worlds. Today, but not only today, we live not in one system of symbols, but we live simultaneously in multiple systems. We live in cities that are labyrinths from which the poor cannot escape. We live in nature. We live in houses of worship. We live in colleges and universities. We live in television sitcoms and in televised savage conflicts. We live in the internet. These systems of symbols whirl around and stream through us. It is as though we are walking in a delirium, in a nightmare amusement park. And each sideshow, each booth and roller coaster dazzles us with its glaring lights and its barked promises of thrills, or at the least of winning a stuffed doll. Galaxies of symbols spin around us, rise and set only to rise again. The symbols we incorporate into ourselves become the habits of our imaginations, the habits by which we interpret who we are and where we are and where we are going. With these, we create or collaborate in making our own characters. What we make becomes our destiny. But in this perplexity that we all know so intimately, We should not be sorry for ourselves. No doubt we shall always be tempted to ask for a completely authoritative and indubitable sign. In this respect, we are not different from the disciples who put their question to Jesus. For they too were living in a complex culture, Jewish, Hellenistic, Roman, etc. Teacher, we would see a sign from you. Or again, they asked, what shall be the sign? They did so without understanding, and I think we do so without understanding, that the sign of their destiny already stood before them. They asked without comprehending that they themselves must embark upon becoming signs of destiny to others before they can begin or could begin to discern the sign after which they sought.